11 out of how many? Beverly asked. 28,618, Richie said calmly. Silence around the table. So I went and beat Irish sweepstakes odds, Richie said. And still no kid to show for it. That give you any good chucks, Eds? Eddie began stubbornly. It still doesn't prove. No, Bill said, it doesn't prove a thing. But it certainly suggests a link. The question is, what do we do now? Have you thought about that, Mike? I thought about it, sure, Mike said. But it was impossible to decide anything until you all got together again and talked, the way you've been doing. There was no way I could predict how this reunion would go until it actually happened. He paused for a long time, looking thoughtfully at them. I've got one idea, he said. But before I tell you what it is, I think we have to agree on whether or not we have business to do here. Do we want to try again to do what we tried to do once before? Do we want to try to kill it again? Or do we just divide the check up six ways and go back to what we were doing? It seems as if... Beverly began, but Mike shook his head at her. He wasn't done. You have to understand that our chances of success are impossible to predict. I know they're not good, just as I know they would have been a little better if Stan was here too. Still not real good, but better. With Stan gone, the circle we made that day is broken. I don't really think we can destroy it, or even send it away for a little while, as we did before, with a broken circle. I think it will kill us, one by one by one, and probably in some extremely horrible ways. As children, we made a complete circle in some way I don't understand even now. I think that, if we agree to go ahead, we'll have to try to form a smaller circle. I don't know if that can be done. I believe it might be possible to think we'd done it, only to discover, when it was too late, well, that it was too late. Mike regarded them again, eyes sunken and tired in his brown face. So I think we need to take a vote. Stay and try it again or go home. Those are the choices. I got you here on the strength of an old promise I wasn't even sure you'd remember. But I can't hold you here on the strength of that promise. The results of that would be worse and more of it. He looked at Bill, and at that moment Bill understood what was coming. He dreaded it, was helpless to stop it, and then, with the same feeling of relief he imagined must come to a suicide when he takes his hands off the wheel of the speeding car and simply uses them to cover his eyes, he accepted it. Mike had gotten them here. Mike had laid it all neatly out for them. And now he was relinquishing the mantle of leadership. He intended that mantle to go back to the person who had worn it in 1958. What do you say, Big Bill? Call the question. Before I do, Bill said, does everyone understand the question? You were going to say something, Bev. She shook her head. All right. I guess the question is, do we stay and fight or do we forget the whole thing? Those in favor of staying? No one at the table moved at all for perhaps 5 seconds, and Bill was reminded of auctions he had attended where the price on an item suddenly soared into the stratosphere, and those who didn't want to bid anymore almost literally played statues. One was afraid to scratch an itch or wave a fly off the end of one's nose for fear the auctioneer would take it for another 5 grand or 25. Bill thought of Georgie. Georgie, who had meant no one any harm, who had only wanted to get out of the house after being cooped up all week. Georgie, with his collar high, his newspaper boat in one hand, snapping the buckles of his yellow rain slicker with the other. Georgie thanking him, and then bending over and kissing Bill's fever-heated cheek. Thanks, Bill. It's a neat boat. He felt the old rage rise in him. But he was older now, and his perspective was wider. It wasn't just Georgie now. A horrid slew of names marched through his head. Betty Ripsom, found frozen into the ground. Cheryl LaMonica, fished out of the Kanduskeag. Matthew Clements, torn from his tricycle. Veronica Grogan, 9 years old and found in a sewer. Stephen Johnson, Lisa Albrecht, all the others, and God only knew how many of the missing. He raised his hand slowly and said, "Let's kill it. This time let's really kill it." For a moment, his hand hung there alone, like the hand of the only kid in class who knows the right answer. The one all the other kids hate. Then Richie sighed, raised his own hand, and said, "What the hell? It can't be any worse than interviewing Ozzy Osbourne." Beverly raised her hand. Her color was back now, but in hectic patches that flared along her cheekbones. She looked both tremendously excited and scared to death. Mike raised his hand. Ben raised his. Eddie Kasprak sat back in his chair, looking as if he wished he could actually melt into it and thus disappear. His face, thin and delicate-looking, was miserably afraid as he looked first right and then left and then back to Bill. For a moment, Bill felt sure Eddie was simply going to push back his chair, rise, and bolt from the room without looking back. Then he raised one hand in the air and grasped his aspirator tightly in the other. "Way to go, Eds," Richie said. "We're really going to have ourselves some chucks this time, I bet."
"Beep, beep, Richie,"
Eddie said in a wavering voice. 6. The losers get dessert.
"So what's your one idea, Mike?"
Bill asked. The mood had been broken by Rose, the hostess, who had come in with a dish of fortune cookies. She looked around at the 6 people who had their hands in the air with a carefully polite lack of curiosity. They lowered them hastily, and no one said anything until Rose was gone again.
"It's simple enough," Mike said, "but it might be pretty damn dangerous, too."
"Spill it," Richie said.
"I think we ought to split up for the rest of the day. I think each of us ought to go back to the place in Derry he or she remembers best. Outside the Barrens, that is. I don't think any of us should go there. Not yet. Think of it as a series of walking tours, if you like."
"What's the purpose, Mike?" Ben asked.
"I'm not entirely sure. You have to understand that I'm going pretty much on intuition here."
"But this has got a good beat, and you can dance to it," Richie said. The others smiled. Mike did not. He nodded instead.
"That's as good a way of putting it as any. Going on intuition is like picking up a beat and dancing to it. Using intuition is a hard thing for grown-ups to do, and that's the main reason I think it might be the right thing for us to do. Kids, after all, operate on it about 80% of the time, at least until they're 14 or so."
"You're talking about plugging back into the situation," Eddie said.
"I suppose so. Anyway, that's my idea. If no specific place to go comes to you, just follow your feet and see where they take you. Then we meet tonight at the library and talk over what happened."
"If anything happens," Ben said.
"Oh, I think things will."
"What sort of things?" Bill asked.
Mike shook his head. "I have no idea. I think whatever happens is apt to be unpleasant. I think it's even possible that one of us may not turn up at the library tonight. No reason for thinking that. Except that intuition thing again."
Silence greeted this.
"Why alone?" Beverly asked finally. "If we're supposed to do this as a group, why do you want us to start alone, Mike? Especially if the risk really turns out to be as high as you think it might be."
"I think I can answer that," Bill said.
"Go ahead, Bill," Mike said.
"It started alone for each of us," Bill said to Beverly. "I don't remember everything, not yet. But I sure remember that much. The picture in George's room that moved. Ben's mummy. The leper that Eddie saw under the porch on Niebolt Street. Mike finding the blood on the grass near the canal in Basie Park. And the bird. There was something about a bird, wasn't there, Mike?" Mike nodded grimly.
"A big bird."
"Yes, but not as friendly as the one on Sesame Street." Richie cackled wildly. "Derry's answer to James Brown gets off a good one. Oh, chillin', is we blessed or is we blessed?"
"Beep, beep, Richie," Mike said, and Richie subsided.
"For you, it was the voice from the pipe and the blood that came out of the drain," Bill said to Beverly. "And for Richie." But here he paused, puzzled.
"I must be the exception that proves the rule, Big Bill," Richie said. "The first time I came in contact with anything that summer that was weird, I mean really big league weird, was in George's room with you. When you and I went back to your house that day and looked at his photo album, the picture of Center Street by the canal started to move. Do you remember?"
"Yes," Bill said. "But are you sure there was nothing before that, Richie? Nothing at all?"
Something flickered in Richie's eyes. He said slowly, "Well, there was the day Henry and his friends chased me. Before the end of school, this was. And I got away from them in the toy department of Freese's. I went up by City Center and sat down on a park bench for a while, and I thought I saw... But that was just something I dreamed."
"What was it?" Beverly asked.
"Nothing," Richie said almost brusquely. "A dream, really."
He looked at Mike.
I don't mind taking a walk, though. It'll kill the afternoon. Views of the old homestead.
So we're agreed? Bill asked. They nodded.
And we'll meet at the library tonight at...
When do you suggest, Mike?
7 o'clock. Ring the bell if you're late. The lib closes at 7 on weekdays until summer vacation starts for the kids.
7 it is, Bill said, and let his eyes range soberly over them.
And be careful. You want to remember that none of us really knows what we're doing.
Think of this as reconnaissance.
If you should see something, don't fight. Run.
I'm a lover, not a fighter,
Richie said in a dreamy Michael Jackson voice.
Well, if we're going to do it, we ought to get going, Ben said. A small smile pulled up the left corner of his mouth. It was more bitter than amused.
Although I'll be damned if I could tell you right this minute where I'm going to go, if the Barons are out. That was the best of it for me, going down there with you guys.
His eyes moved to Beverly, held there for a moment, moved away.
I can't think of any place else that means very much to me. Probably I'll just wander around for a couple of hours looking at buildings and getting wet feet.
You'll find a place to go, Haystack, Richie said. Visit some of your old food stops and gas up.
Ben laughed. My capacity's gone down a lot since I was 11. I'm so full you guys may just have to roll me out of here.
Well, I'm all set, Eddie said.
Wait a sec,
Beverly cried as they began to push back from their chairs. The fortune cookies, don't forget those.
Yeah, Richie said. I can see mine now. You will soon be eaten up by a large monster. Have a nice day.
They laughed, and Mike passed the little bowl of fortune cookies to Richie, who took one and then sent it on around the table. Bill noticed that no one opened his or her cookie until each had one. They sat with the little hat-shaped cookies either in front of them or held in their hands, and even as Beverly, still smiling, picked hers up, Bill felt a cry rising in his throat.
No. No, don't do that. It's part of it. Put it back. Don't open it.
But it was too late. Beverly had broken hers open. Ben was doing the same to his. Eddie was cutting into his with the edge of his fork. And just before Beverly's smile turned to a grimace of horror, Bill had time to think.
We knew. Somehow we knew. Because no one simply bit into his or her fortune cookie. That would have been the normal thing to do. But no one did it. Somehow, some part of us still remembers everything.
And he found that insensate under-knowledge somehow the most horrifying realization of all. It spoke more eloquently than Mike could have about how surely and deeply it had touched each one of them, and how its touch was still upon them. Blood spurted up from Beverly's fortune cookie as if from a slashed artery. It splashed across her hand and then gouted onto the white napery which covered the table, staining it a bright red that sank in and then spread out in grasping pink fingers. Eddie Kasprak uttered a strangled cry and pushed himself away from the table with such a sudden, revolted confusion of arms and legs that his chair nearly tipped over. A huge bug, its chitinous carapace, an ugly yellow-brown, was pushing its way out of his fortune cookie as if from a cocoon. Its obsidian eyes stared blindly forward. As it lurched onto Eddie's bread-and-butter plate, cookie crumbs fell from its back in a little shower that Bill heard clearly and which came back to haunt his dreams when he slept for a while later that afternoon. As it freed itself entirely, it rubbed its thin rear legs together, producing a dry, reedy hum, and Bill realized it was some sort of terribly mutated cricket. It lumbered to the edge of the dish and tumbled onto the tablecloth on its back.
Oh, God, Richie managed in a choked voice. Oh, God, Big Bill, it's an eye, dear God, it's an eye, a fucking eye.
Bill's head snapped around, and he saw Richie staring down at his fortune cookie, his lips drawn back from his teeth in a kind of sickened leer. A chunk of his cookie's glazed surface had fallen onto the tablecloth, revealing a hole from which a human eyeball stared with glazed intensity. Cookie crumbs were scattered across its blank brown iris and embedded in its sclera. Ben Hanscom threw his, not a calculated throw, but the startled reaction of a person who has been utterly surprised by some piece of nasty work. As his fortune cookie rolled across the table, Bill saw two teeth inside its hollow, their roots dark with clotted blood. They rattled together like seeds in a hollow gourd. He looked back at Beverly and saw she was hitching in breath to scream. Her eyes were fixed on the thing that had crawled out of Eddie's cookie, the thing that was now kicking its sluggish legs as it lay overturned on the tablecloth. Bill got moving. He was not thinking, only reacting.
Intuition, he thought crazily as he lunged out of his seat and clapped his hand over Beverly's mouth just before she could utter the scream. Here I am, acting on intuition. Mike should be proud of me. What came out of Beverly's mouth was not a scream, but a strangled oomph. Eddie was making those whistling sounds that Bill remembered so well. No problem there. A good honk on the old lung sucker would set Eddie right. Right as a trivet, Freddie Firestone would have said. And Bill wondered, not for the first time, why a person had such weird thoughts at times like these. He glanced around fiercely at the others, and what came out was something else from that summer, something that sounded both impossibly archaic and exactly right. Dummy up, all of you. Not one sound. Just dummy up. Rich wiped a hand across his mouth. Mike's complexion had gone a dirty gray, but he nodded at Bill. All of them moved away from the table. Bill had not opened his own fortune cookie, but now he could see its sides moving slowly in and out. Bulge and relax. Bulge and relax. Bulge and relax. As his own party favor tried to escape. Oomph, Beverly said against his hand again, her breath tickling his palm. Dummy up, Bev, he said, and took his hand away. Her face seemed to be all eyes. Her mouth twitched. Bill, did you see? Her eyes strayed back to the cricket and then fixed there. The cricket appeared to be dying. Its rugose eyes stared back at her, and presently Beverly began to moan. Quick, quit that, he said grimly. Pull back to the table.
I can't, Billy. I can't get near that thing.
You can. You have to. He heard footsteps, light and quick, coming up the short hall on the other side of the beaded curtain. He looked around at the others. All of you, pull up to the table. Talk. Look natural. Beverly looked at him, eyes pleading, and Bill shook his head. He sat down and pulled his chair in, trying not to look at the fortune cookie on his plate. It had swelled like some unimaginable boil which was filling with pus. And still it pulsed slowly in and out.
I could have bitten into that, he thought faintly.
Eddie triggered his aspirator down his throat again, gasping mist into his lungs in a long, thin, screaming sound.
So who do you think's going to win the pennant?
Bill asked Mike, smiling insanely. Rose came through the curtain just then, her face politely questioning. Out of the corner of his eye, Bill saw that Bev had pulled up to the table again.
Good girl, he thought.
I think the Chicago Bears look good, Mike said.
Everything is all right? Rose asked.
Fine, Bill said. He cocked a thumb in Eddie's direction. Our friend had an asthma attack. He took his medication. He's better now.
Rose looked at Eddie, concerned.
Better,
Eddie wheezed.
You would like that I clear now?
Very shortly, Mike said, and offered a large false smile.
Was good?
Her eyes surveyed the table again, a bit of doubt overlaying a deep well of serenity. She did not see the cricket, the eye, the teeth, or the way Bill's fortune cookie appeared to be breathing. Her eye similarly passed over the bloodstain splotched on the tablecloth without trouble.
Everything was very good, Beverly said and smiled, a more natural smile than either Bill's or Mike's.
It seemed to set Rose's mind at rest, convinced her that if something had gone wrong in here, it had been the fault of neither Rose's service nor her kitchen.
Girl's got a lot of guts, Bill thought.
Fortunes were good? Rose asked.
Well, Richie said, I don't know about the others, but I for one got a real eyeful.
Bill heard a minute cracking sound. He looked down at his plate and saw a leg poking blindly out of his fortune cookie. It scraped at his plate.
I could have bitten into that, he thought again,
but held onto his smile.
Very fine, he said.
Richie was looking at Bill's plate. A great grayish-black fly was slowly birthing itself from the collapsing remains of his cookie. It buzzed weakly. Yellowish goo flowed sluggishly out of the cookie and puddled on the tablecloth. There was the smell now, the bland, thick smell of an infected wound.
Well, if I can help you in no way at this moment.
Not right now, Ben said. A wonderful meal, most unusual.
I leave you then, she said, and bowed out through the beaded curtain.
The beads were still swaying and clacking together when all of them pushed away from the table again.
What is it?
Ben asked huskily, looking at the thing on Bill's plate.
A fly, Bill said. A mutant fly. Courtesy of a writer named George Langlahan, I think. He wrote a story called The Fly. A movie was made out of it, not a terribly good one, but the story scared the bejesus out of me. It's up to its old tricks, all right. That fly business has been in my mind a lot lately, because I've sort of been planning this novel, Road Bugs, I've been thinking of calling it. I know the title sounds pretty stupid, but you see...
Excuse me, Beverly said distantly. I have to vomit, I think.
She was gone before any of the men could rise. Bill shook out his napkin and threw it over the fly, which was the size of a baby sparrow. Nothing so large could have come from something as small as a Chinese fortune cookie, but it had. It buzzed twice under the napkin and then fell silent.
Jesus, Eddie said faintly.
Let's get the righteous fuck out of here, Mike said. We can meet Bev in the lobby. Beverly was just coming out of the women's room as they gathered by the cash register. She looked pale but composed. Mike paid the check, kissed Rose's cheek, and then they all went out into the rainy afternoon.
Does this change anyone's mind? Mike asked.
I don't think it changes mine, Ben said.
No,
Eddie said.
What mind? Richie said.
Bill shook his head and then looked at Beverly.
I'm staying, she said. Bill, what did you mean when you said it's up to its old tricks?
I've been thinking about writing a bug story, he said. That Langlahan story had woven itself into my thinking, and so I saw a fly.
Yours was blood, Beverly.
Why was blood on your mind?
I guess because of the blood from the drain, Beverly said at once.
The blood that came out of the bathroom drain in the old place when I was 11.
But was that really it? She didn't really think so, because what had flashed immediately to mind when the blood spurted across her fingers in a warm little jet had been the bloody footprint she had left behind her after stepping on the broken perfume bottle. Tom and...
Bevy, sometimes I worry a lot.
Her father.
You got a bug, too, Bill said to Eddie.
Why?
Not just a bug, Eddie said. A cricket. There are crickets in our basement. $200,000 house, and we can't get rid of the crickets. They drive us crazy at night. A couple of nights before Mike called, I had a really terrible nightmare. I dreamed I woke up and my bed was full of crickets. I was trying to shoot them with my aspirator, but all it would do when I squeezed it was make crackling noises. And just before I woke up, I realized it was full of crickets, too.
The hostess didn't see any of it, Ben said.
He looked at Beverly. Like your folks never saw the blood that came out of the drain, even though it was everywhere.
Yes, she said.
They stood looking at each other in the fine spring rain. Mike looked at his watch.
There'll be a bus in 20 minutes or so, he said. I can take four of you in my car if we cram, or I can call some cabs. Whatever way you want to do it.
I think I'm going to walk from here, Bill said. I don't know where I'm going, but a little fresh air seems like a great idea along about now.
I'm going to call a cab, Ben said.
I'll share it with you if you drop me off downtown, Richie said.
Okay, where are you going?
Richie shrugged.
Not really sure yet.
The others elected to wait for the bus.
7 tonight, Mike reminded. And be careful, all of you.
They agreed to be careful, although Bill did not know how you could truthfully make a promise like that when dealing with such a formidable array of unknown factors. He started to say so, then looked at their faces and saw that they knew it already. He walked away instead, raising one hand briefly in farewell. The misty air felt good against his face. The walk back to town would be a long one, but that was all right. He had a lot to think about. He was glad that the reunion was over and the business had begun.
Chapter 11. Walking Tours.
1. Ben Hanscom makes a withdrawal. Richie Tozier got out of the cab at the three-way intersection of Kansas Street, Center Street, and Main Street, and Ben dismissed it at the top of the Up Mile Hill. The driver was Bill's religious fella, but neither Richie nor Ben knew it. Dave had lapsed into a morose silence. Ben could have gotten off with Richie, he supposed, but it seemed better somehow that they all start off alone. He stood on the corner of Kansas Street and Daltrey Close, watching the cab pull back into traffic. Hands stuffed deeply into his pockets, trying to get the lunch's hideous conclusion out of his mind. He couldn't do it. His thoughts kept returning to that black-gray fly crawling out of the fortune cookie on Bill's plate, its veined wings plastered to its back. He would try to divert his mind from this unhealthy image, think he had succeeded, only to discover 5 minutes later that his mind was back at it.
I'm trying to justify it somehow, he thought,
meaning it not in the moral sense, but rather in the mathematical one. Buildings are built by observing certain natural laws. Natural laws may be expressed by equations. Equations must be justified. Where was the justification in what had happened less than half an hour ago? Let it alone, he told himself, not for the first time. You can't justify it, so let it alone. Very good advice. The problem was that he couldn't take it. He remembered that the day after he had seen the mummy on the iced-up canal, his life had gone on as usual. He had known that whatever it had been had come very close to getting him, but his life had gone on. He had attended school, taken an arithmetic test, visited the library when school was over, and eaten with his usual heartiness. He had simply incorporated the thing he had seen on the canal into his life, and if he had almost been killed by it, well, kids were always almost getting killed. They dashed across streets without looking. They got horsing around in the lake and suddenly realized they had floated far past their depth on their rubber rafts and had to paddle back. They fell off monkey bars on their asses and out of trees on their heads. Now, standing here in the fading drizzle in front of a trustworthy hardware store that had been a pawn shop in 1958, Fratty Brothers, Ben recalled, the double windows always full of pistols and rifles and straight razors and guitars hung up by their necks like exotic animals. It occurred to him that kids were better at almost dying, and they were also better at incorporating the inexplicable into their lives. They believed implicitly in the invisible world. Miracles both bright and dark were to be taken into consideration, oh yes, most certainly. But they by no means stopped the world. A sudden upheaval of beauty or terror at 10 did not preclude an extra cheese dog or two for lunch at noon. But when you grew up, all that changed. You no longer lay awake in your bed, sure something was crouching in the closet or scratching at the window. But when something did happen, something beyond rational explanation, the circuits overloaded. The axons and dendrites got hot. You started to jitter and jive. You started to shake, rattle, and roll. Your imagination started to hop and bop and do the funky chicken all over your nerves. You couldn't just incorporate what had happened into your life experience. It didn't digest. Your mind kept coming back to it, pawing it lightly like a kitten with a ball of string, until eventually, of course, you either went crazy or got to a place where it was impossible for you to function. And if that happens, Ben thought, it's got me. Us. Cold. He started to walk up Kansas Street, not conscious of heading any place in particular, and thought suddenly, what did we do with the silver dollar? He still couldn't remember. The silver dollar, Ben. Beverly saved your life with it. Yours. Maybe all the others, and especially Bill's. It almost ripped my guts out before Beverly did... What? What did she do? And how was it able to work? She backed it off, and we all helped her, but how? A word came to him suddenly, a word that meant nothing at all, but which tightened his flesh. Chud. He looked down at the sidewalk and for a moment saw the shape of a turtle chalked there, and the world seemed to swim before his eyes. He shut them tightly, and when he opened them saw it was not a turtle, only a hopscotch grid half erased by the light rain. Chud. What did that mean? I don't know, he said aloud. And when he looked around quickly to see if anyone had heard him talking to himself, he saw that he had turned off Kansas Street and onto Costello Avenue. At lunch, he had told the others that the Barrens were the only place in Derry where he had felt happy as a kid. But that wasn't quite true, was it? There had been another place. Either accidentally or unconsciously, he had come to that other place, the Derry Public Library. He stood in front of it for a minute or two, hands still in his pockets. It hadn't changed. He admired its lines as much now as he had as a child. Like so many other stone buildings that had been well designed, it succeeded in confounding the closely observing eye with contradictions. Its stone solidity was somehow balanced by the delicacy of its arches and slim columns. It looked both bank-safe squat and yet slim and clean. Well, it was slim, as city buildings went, especially those erected around the turn of the century, and the windows, crisscrossed with narrow strips of iron, were graceful and rounded. These contradictions saved it from ugliness, and he was not entirely surprised to feel a wave of love for the place. Nothing much had changed on Costello Avenue. Glancing along it, he could see the Dairy Community House, and he found himself wondering if the Costello Avenue Market was still there at the point where the avenue, which was semicircular, rejoined Kansas Street. He walked across the library lawn, barely noticing that his dress boots were getting wet, to have a look at that glassed-in passageway between the grown-ups' library and the children's library. It was also unchanged, and from here, standing just outside the bowed branches of a weeping willow tree, he could see people passing back and forth. The old delight flooded him, and he really forgot what had happened at the end of the reunion lunch for the first time. He could remember walking around to this very same spot as a kid, only in the winter, plowing his way through snow that was almost hip-deep, and then standing for as long as 15 minutes. He would come at dusk, he remembered, and again it was the contrast that drew him and held him there with the tips of his fingers going numb and snow melting inside his green gum rubber boots. It would be drawing down dark out where he was, the world going purple with early winter shadows, the sky the color of ashes in the east and embers in the west. It would be cold where he was, 10 degrees perhaps, and chillier than that if the wind was blowing across from the frozen barrens, as it so often did. But there, less than 40 yards from where he stood, people walked back and forth in their shirt sleeves. There, less than 40 yards from where he stood, was a tubeway of bright white light thrown by the overhead fluorescence. Little kids giggled together, high school sweethearts held hands, and if the librarian saw them, she would make them stop. It was somehow magical, magical in a good way that he had been too young to account for with such mundane things as electric power and oil heat. The magic was that glowing cylinder of light and life connecting those two dark buildings like a lifeline. The magic was in watching people walk through it across the dark snowfield, untouched by either the dark or the cold. It made them lovely and godlike. Eventually, he would walk away, as he was doing now, and circle the building to the front door, as he was doing now. But he would always pause and look back once, as he was doing now, before the bulking stone shoulder of the adult library cut off the sight line to the delicate umbilicus. Ruefully amused at the ache of nostalgia around his heart, Ben went up the steps to the door of the adult library, paused for a moment on the narrow veranda just inside the pillars, always so high and cool no matter how hot the day. Then he pulled open the iron-bound door with the book drop slot in it and went into the quiet. The force of memory almost dizzied him for a moment as he stepped into the mild light of the hanging glass globes. The force was not physical, not like a shot to the jaw or a slap. It was more akin to that queer feeling of time doubling back on itself that people call, for want of a better term, déjà vu. Ben had had the feeling before, but it had never struck him with such disorienting power. For the moment or two he stood inside the door, he felt literally lost in time, not really sure how old he was. Was he 38 or 11? Here was the same murmuring quiet, broken only by an occasional whisper, the faint thud of a librarian stamping books or overdue notices, the hushed riffle of newspaper or magazine pages being turned. He loved the quality of the light as much now as then. It slanted through the high windows, gray as a pigeon's wing on this rainy afternoon, a light that was somehow somnolent and dozy. He walked across the wide floor with its red and black linoleum pattern almost completely worn away, trying, as he had always tried back then, to hush the sound of his footfalls. The adult library rose up to a dome in the middle, and all sounds were magnified. He saw that the circular iron staircases leading to the stacks were still there, one on either side of the horseshoe-shaped main desk, but he also saw that a tiny cagework elevator had been added at some point in the 25 years since he and his mama had moved away. It was something of a relief. It drove a wedge into that suffocating feeling of déjà vu. He felt like an interloper crossing the wide floor, a spy from another country. He kept expecting the librarian at the desk to raise her head, look at him, and then challenge him in clear, ringing tones that would shatter the concentration of every reader here and focus every eye upon him. "You, yes, you. What are you doing here? You have no business here. You're from outside. You're from before. Go back where you came from. Go back right now before I call the police." She did look up, a young girl, pretty, and for one absurd moment it seemed to Ben that the fantasy was really going to come true, that his heart rose into his throat as her pale blue eyes touched his. Then they passed on indifferently, and Ben found he could walk again. If he was a spy, he hadn't been found out. He passed under the coil of one of the narrow and almost suicidally steep wrought iron staircases on his way to the corridor leading to the children's library, and was amused to realize, only after he had done it, that he had run down another old track of his childhood behavior. He had looked up, hoping, as he had hoped as a kid, to see a girl in a skirt coming down those steps. He could remember. Now he could remember. Glancing up there for no reason at all one day when he was 8 or 9 and looking right up the chino skirt of a pretty high school girl and seeing her clean pink underwear. And the sudden sunlit glint of Beverly Marsh's ankle bracelet had shot an arrow of something more primitive than simple love or affection through his heart on the last day of school in 1958. So had the sight of the high school girl's panties affected him. He could remember sitting at a table in the children's library and thinking of that unexpected view for perhaps as long as 20 minutes, his cheeks and forehead hot, a book about the history of trains open and unread before him, his penis a hard little branch in his pants, a branch that had sunk its roots all the way up into his belly. He had fantasized the two of them married, living in a small house on the outskirts of town, indulging in pleasures he did not in the least understand. The feelings had passed off almost as suddenly as they had come, but he had never walked under the stairway again without glancing up. He hadn't ever seen anything else as interesting or affecting. Once a fat lady working her way down with ponderous care, but he had looked away from that sight hastily, feeling ashamed, like a violator. But the habit persisted. He had done it again now, as a grown man. He walked slowly down the glassed-in passageway, noticing other changes now. Yellow decals that said, OPEC loves it when you waste energy, so save a watt, had been plastered over the switch plates. The framed pictures on the far wall when he entered this scaled-down world of blonde wood tables and small blonde wood chairs, this world where the drinking fountain was only 4 feet high, were not of Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, but of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Reagan, Ben recalled, had been host of GE Theater in the year that Ben had graduated from the fifth grade. And George Bush would not have seen 30 yet. But that feeling of deja vu swept him again. He was helpless before it, and this time he felt the numb horror of a man who finally realizes, after half an hour of helpless splashing, that the shore is growing no closer and he is drowning. It was story hour, and over in the corner a group of roughly a dozen little ones sat solemnly on their tiny chairs in a semicircle, listening.
"Who is that trip-trapping upon my bridge?"
the librarian said in the low, growling tones of the troll in the story. And Ben thought,
"When she raises her head, I'll see that it's Miss Davies. Yes, it'll be Miss Davies, and she won't look a day older."
But when she did raise her head, he saw a much younger woman than Miss Davies had been even then. Some of the children covered their mouths and giggled, but others only watched her, their eyes reflecting the eternal fascination of the fairy story. Would the monster be bested, or would it feed?
"It is I, Billy Goat Gruff, trip-trapping on your bridge," the librarian went on, and Ben, pale, walked past her.
How can it be the same story?
The very same story.
Am I supposed to believe that's just coincidence? Because I don't. God damn it, I just don't.
He bent to the drinking fountain, bending so far he felt like Richie doing one of his salami-salami-baloney routines.
"I ought to talk to someone," he thought, panicked. "Mike, Bill, someone. Is something really stapling the past and present together here? Or am I only imagining it? Because if I'm not, I'm not sure I bargained for this much.
He looked at the checkout desk, and his heart seemed to stop in his chest for a moment before beginning to race double time. The poster was simple, stark, and familiar. It said simply, "Remember the curfew, 7 p.m., Derry Police Department." In that instant, it all seemed to come clear to him. It came in a grisly flash of light, and he realized that the vote they had taken was a joke. There was no turning back, never had been. They were on a track as preordained as the memory track which had caused him to look up when he passed under the stairway leading to the stacks. There was an echo here in Derry, a deadly echo, and all they could hope for was that the echo could be changed enough in their favor to allow them to escape with their lives.
"Christ,"
he muttered, and scrubbed a palm up one cheek, hard.
"Can I help you, sir?"
a voice at his elbow asked, and he jumped a little. It was a girl of perhaps 17, her dark blonde hair held back from her pretty high schooler's face with barrettes. A library assistant, of course. They'd had them in 1958, too, high school girls and boys who shelved books, showed kids how to use the card catalog, discussed book reports and school papers, helped bewildered scholars with their footnotes and bibliographies. The pay was a pittance, but there were always kids willing to do it. It was agreeable work. On the heels of this, reading the girl's pleasant but questioning look a little more closely, he remembered that he no longer really belonged here. He was a giant in the land of little people, an intruder. In the adults' library, he had felt uneasy about the possibility of being looked at or spoken to, but here it was something of a relief. For one thing, it proved he was still an adult, and the fact that the girl was clearly browless under her thin Western-style shirt was also more relief than turn-on. If proof that this was 1985 and not 1958 was needed, the clearly limbed points of her nipples against the cotton of her shirt was it.
"No, thank you," he said, and then for no reason at all that he could understand, he heard himself add, "I was looking for my son." "Oh, what's his name? Maybe I've seen him." She smiled. "I know most of the kids."
"His name is Ben Hanscom," he said, "but I don't see him here."
"Tell me what he looks like, and I'll give him a message if there is one."
"Well," Ben said, uncomfortable now and beginning to wish he had never started this, "he's on the stout side. He looks a little bit like me, but it's no big deal, miss. If you see him, just tell him his dad popped by on his way home."
"I will," she said and smiled, but the smile didn't reach her eyes, and Ben suddenly realized that she hadn't come over and spoken to him out of a simple politeness or a wish to help. She happened to be a library assistant in the children's library in a town where 9 children had been slain over a span of 8 months. You see, a strange man in this scaled-down world where adults rarely come except to drop their kids off or pick them up. You're suspicious, of course.
"Thank you," he said, gave her a smile he hoped was reassuring, and then got the hell out.
He walked back through the corridor to the adults' library and went to the desk on an impulse he didn't understand. But of course they were supposed to follow their impulses this afternoon, weren't they? Follow their impulses and see where they led. The nameplate on the circulation desk identified the pretty young librarian as Carol Danner. Behind her, Ben could see a door with a frosted glass panel. Lettered on this was Michael Hanlon, head librarian.
"May I help you?" Ms. Danner asked.
"I think so," Ben said. "That is, I hope so. I'd like to get a library card."
"Very good," she said, and took out a form. "Are you a resident of Derry?"
"Not presently."
"Home address, then?"
"Rural Star Route 2, Hemingford Home, Nebraska."
He paused for a moment, a little amused by her stare, and then reeled off the zip code.
59341.
"Is this a joke, Mr. Hanscom?"
"Not at all."
"Are you moving to Derry, then?"
"I have no plans to, no."
"This is a long way to come to borrow books, isn't it? Don't they have libraries in Nebraska?"
"It's kind of a sentimental thing," Ben said.
He would have thought telling a stranger this would be embarrassing, but he found it wasn't.
"I grew up in Derry, you see. This is the first time I've been back since I was a kid. I've been walking around, seeing what's changed and what hasn't. And all at once it occurred to me that I spent about 10 years of my life here between ages 3 and 13, and I don't have a single thing to remember those years by, not so much as a postcard. I had some silver dollars, but I lost one of them and gave the rest to a friend. I guess what I want is a souvenir of my childhood. It's late, but don't they say better late than never?" End of side 14.